Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on dry eye disease. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Mark Blumenstein, Corey Lappin, and Selena McGee discuss the diagnosis and treatment of dry eye disease. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Bausch and Lomb. The expert panel starts by discussing the risk factors associated with dry eye disease.
Now, we start thinking risk factor analysis, start thinking of all the different risks that are associated with dry disease, as we mentioned before, right? Whether it be clogged coma, wearing contacts, autoimmune disorders, diabetes, all the different risk factors that are associated with these patients you have to take into account. I love how they had smoking as one of the risk factors, because smoking is just ubiquitous. If a patient ever says to you, why is this happening to me, and they smoke, just point at the cigarettes. Yeah. Doesn't even matter if it is, just go, come on, man. You know, it's the cigarettes.
And that goes for vaping too. They're finding that because, you know, then they're like, I don't smoke, I vape. There's a difference. But they're starting to find too that that can also be detrimental. So anything along with that, again, like Mark said, it's going to be causing issues.
Here, the panel reviews how they approach testing and diagnosing patients who present with dry eye symptoms.
So when you look at this, and Deuce 2 said, okay, we need non-invasive tear breakup time, osmolarity, and corneal staining, which I do all of those. But actually, I really like tear meniscus height because it's an easy test to do that you don't have to have any special equipment. You're already putting in staining. You can assess when you look at enough of that to know what's normal. You'll know when it's too high and you've got an epiphora issue and maybe it's a mechanical problem, but it's not dry eye disease, but their symptoms are very related to dry eye. And then you'll know when it's too low and you need to replace that tear volume. So I like tear meniscus height a lot. Yeah. And that's the one that's left off of
and
here.
And I think that one's one of the most underutilized because how many of you in here use Schirmer strips? Thank God.
Yeah.
Because
put your hand down, Canada.
Because this is one thing where it can be great if you have to get a quantitative value, but it just intrinsically is going to disrupt basal tear production. You're putting a foreign body on the surface. It's going to elicit that reflex tear. Oh, well, don't worry, I anesthetized them first. Well, great, now you just turned off the corneal nerves, and again, now they can't get basal tearing. So it's something that we've used because we didn't have anything better, but really, tear meniscus height is the same proxy for tear production. The tear meniscus will hold 70 to 90% of the volume of the tears on the ocular surface. So you can get a bunch of non-invasive, basically, information of tear production with that. So I love tear meniscus height, too. I think it's a great test. Yeah.
Next, the panel discusses the ASCRS algorithm for diagnosing preoperative ocular surface disease.
This was Chris Starr and Priya Gupta, and they were coming up with ways to kind of do perioperative OSD diagnosis, because, you know, ophthalmology is like right on that ocular surface disease. And what I mean by that is they have their optometrist do it for them. So, you know, when a patient comes in, they came up with this whole kind of moniker. And I love the fact that it's, you know, dry screening, you talk about symptoms and you separate symptoms by if they're negative on the screening and then signs. And then if it's OSD, it's likely. And then you do a clinical exam. And the thing that I like about the clinical exam is that it really boils down to four simple things: look, lift, push, pull. Or look, lift, pull, push. But more importantly, you see the quality of the meibum and you see whether there is meibum at all.
Or not. Yeah.
What I like to do is take 15 of the meibomian glands in the inferior lid, I push on it, and I give it a grade. Okay? Zero means nothing's happening. One means it looks like a one. It's like kind of hard and just kind of, you know, just like toothpaste. A two is like baby spit up, and a three is olive oil. That is a unicorn in my practice. I gotta be honest with you.
So I don't use the value, I just do the description. I say if it's olive oil, I like to give the descriptor because in my mind that kind of lets me know the same thing.
What glands do you assess? Just the central five?
So I like to do, I press on all, I kind of divide it into thirds and I press, but if I'm going to give it that numeric value, I'm gonna use the central glands because that's kind of standard, but I kind of like to work around because you're going to see there's different regions of the lid that tend to get hit a little bit more differently. Especially if you've ever done gland expression, have you noticed as you kind of go, you're like nothing, nothing? Oh, lots centrally and then nothing temporal and nasal. So I think the central ones will give you the most information about the quality because a lot of time that temporal nasal, you just don't get anything. And then you assume, oh, they're not functioning at all.
You?
So I do a modified version of that. I do three sections, nasal, central, temporal, and then I just put a descriptor because these numbers would really confuse me. So
perfluorohexyl octane is a medication used to treat dry eye disease. Here, the panel reviews its structure and functionality.
For those of you that don't know, perfluorohexyl octane is a semi-fluorinated alkane. For all intents and purposes, this is a 6 of the carbons have fluorine, and the fluorine likes to be in the air, whereas the hydrocarbons like to be in, whether it be water or kind of the lipid area.
And this molecule is really interesting in the way that it organizes itself on the front surface. And remember, it stays in the tear film for about 6 hours. And Mark's right, those 6 fluorinated alkane, those 6 fluorinated carbons are aerophilic. So they're going to be oriented in the air, and your 8 saturated hydrocarbons are going to be situated in the tear film. Or when you blink, you know, if you put another drop in, think of it like a pool of water that you've taken all of those like balls from the pizza place, the CC's pizza that the little kids play in, that you're like cringing on what's even inside of all of that. But if you layer a pool with all of those little balls, think of that as your perfluorohexyl octane bobbing on the front surface, and the tear film exists underneath it. And we want to stabilize the tear film underneath it. That's what it's doing, and that's how it organizes itself.
I think the other important thing to know also is that not every semi-fluorinated alkane acts the same. The longer chains act differently. They don't dissolve as quickly. They stay on the eye longer. They have, you know, low vapor pressure, slow evaporation rate means that they linger on the outer surface, whereas the smaller semifluorinated alkanes, the shorter molecules, tend to kind of dissolve into the aqueous, so they tend to penetrate more.
Yes.
So the key here is this mimics MIBOM.
Data from several trials of perfluorohexyl octane, including the GOBI trial, are discussed by the panel.
And what's beautiful about this is if you look at the GOBI study, right, they did this study where every person had to have some form of signs of meibomian gland dysfunction, not super overt. They weren't like, you know, crazy dead meibomian glands. And they also had to have some signs of corneal staining. So they had to demonstrate that they had dry disease. And you can see the methods that they used here. And what's really exciting about the data is that their primary sign and symptom endpoints were basically a change in total corneal fluorescein staining, and they also used an eye dryness score. So if you look at the data here, we see clinically significant improvement in both total corneal fluorescein staining within that short period of time here, and then our eye dryness score also clinically significant change. And this is all within that 8-week period. When you look at adverse events, what's the most common adverse event we see?
Blurry vision.
A tiny bit. But I love that, because if you've never used that.
It's 13 out of 614 people that got perfluorohexyl octane. It's tiny.
It's nothing. You know, the Mojave data, which is essentially the exact same, because you have to do 2 clinical trials, and you can see the results are literally exactly the same, consistent with GOBI across 1,200 patients.
And it's basically, like Mark said, the big thing with this, it's a small drop. It's about 1/3 of a regular drop size. The other thing is it contains no water, so there's no pH, there's no preservative. So they don't even feel it go in. A lot of time it won't elicit that blink response. And what I think you were going to, Mark, with that is use that blur side effect to your advantage. That's how they know it got in. I'm like, put it in, blink. If your vision's a little bit blurred, then you know you got it in. Otherwise, they just keep putting it in because they don't even feel it on the surface of the eye.
Additionally, the panel reviews the evidence for lifitegrast for the treatment of dry eye disease.
I do want to mention lifitegrast, which has been around for a while. And I think for a lot of us, you know, we just, the coverage on this medication is ridiculous. And so I think, you know, when you start thinking immunomodulators, you got to remember in their OPUS data, they were able to demonstrate that they had eye dryness scores that were improved within 2 weeks. It's one of the only and it's the fastest symptom relief for any of the immunomodulators that are out there with very little side effects. All of the immunomodulators have some side effects.
Yeah.
And I think the key here is that if you tell patients what to expect, then it just becomes kind of normal. If you don't tell them, then that becomes a complication. This was a study that used lifitegrast prior to cataract surgery. And it was kind of an interesting study. What he did is he basically started patients, before they started lifitegrast, he went and evaluated speed scores. So if you look at the far left-hand side there, this is the percentage of patients that had low speed scores less than 10, you see 6 to 10 or 0 to 5. So you see the percentage there. And as they did their post-lefitograph, they did it for 2 weeks. They came in, did their testing, they had their cataract surgery, and then they did it again, continued it on for another 2 weeks. So you have pre-nothing, 2 weeks, then the surgery, then post. And you see the post where the patients have been on the lefitograph are doing exceptionally well. Okay, you see that very little to none of these patients have anything greater than 10. When you look at the mean improvement in corneal staining, it's kind of a similar scenario. We have a clinically significant improvement in corneal staining compared to the patients that were basically not using lefitograph. So in this study, this kind of real world before and after cataract study, they basically found that the biometrics were actually a little bit better. And so the key takeaway here from this study is that, you know what, you should basically take every single patient that comes in for cataract surgery and see how can you manage that ocular surface disease to get the best results.
Finally, the expert panel briefly discusses their approaches to evaluating their patient's response to treatment.
You know, how do you guys evaluate therapeutic response? This is going to go back to the original question of Lisa.
How do you define success,
yes,
right?
Yep.
So part of it is speed. So part of it is their questions. But I'm really happy if I take someone from 24 out of 28 to 17 out of 28. I'm happy if I get them from 10 to 6. It's never going to be zero. And the other thing that I'm happy is when I can balance osmolarity, when my tear meniscus height goes up, when I have reduced corneal staining. I rely heavily on all of those clinical signs and objective testing to tell me where I am in that moment.
Yeah. And it's the same thing. I tell my patients, we're looking at two things. I'm like, we have two categories. One, how you feel. That's going to be the most practical for you. But same thing, the objective testing, like how you feel is great. That's what we want to get to a point where, you know, whether the value is this or that and speed is one thing. Are you comfortable? And then for me, I'm looking at the objective data because I want to make sure that structurally speaking, things are stabilized.
Right.
Yeah, so for me, I'm a little bit different because I don't get in the weeds. I mean, I literally walk in and tell patients how they're doing. And part of it is a refractive surgery kind of like technique, because back in the day, patients come and go, I don't know. And I'm like, girl, you're doing amazeballs. You think so? But they're like 20/70. But you know what? They're functioning. So I will walk in and say, wow, it looks like things look better. It's like, you think so. And I will evaluate whether it be the refraction, whether it be just the way their eyes look. But I always start off by telling them how I think they're doing, because I feel they're looking for us. Mm-hmm. To do that, as opposed to we go in and say, how are you doing? It's like, I don't know, you tell me.
That's why you can't rely on symptoms, because you'll have a patient who is highly symptomatic and their osmolarity has normalized or their corneal staining's better, and they're looking to you like, but I don't feel any better. That's why you cannot define success for a patient based on symptoms.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.